Tonight on Arena, ex-Waterboy Joe Chester on his new solo album, and Esther Saffron 4 reworks her son Jonathan's fiction to find the facts of her life. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. We start this evening with John O'Donnell, the award-winning poet and barrister who has just published his debut short story collection. Almost the Same Blue brings together 15 tales of people in extremis. Tales of deceit, love and death, unfolding in backdrops as diverse as post-crash Ireland, the south of France and Renaissance Rome. John O'Donnell joins me now. John, we know you primarily as a poet. Your latest poetry collection, Sunlight, New and Selected Poems, published by Daedalus in 2018. Have the stories been going on in camera, to use the legal term?
Very good, John. Very good.
During all this time.
Well, somebody, I hadn't written stories since I was in school. But in 2008, somebody came up to me in the Law Library and said, we're putting together an anthology of short stories and we'd like you to contribute one. Oh, and by the way, in case you're thinking of getting out of it, it's for charity. So I was stuck. And not having written a story for 30 years, I was left trying to find out how I might go about writing one. But in the course of the summer, I read an article in a newspaper about a rugby player who had been crippled playing a game. And I thought about that story because I'd played the game myself when I was younger. I thought about that and what that must be like. And then I wrote the story. The first story that I ever wrote was the story called Promise, which is in the book, about a crippled rugby player who persuades his best friend to take him to Switzerland.
So it was that sort of spur from a colleague that sent you off to do that. And in writing about the rugby situation there, because it's something I wanted to ask you about a couple of the stories in the book, you did take a real life situation, but how quickly did it become fictionalized? How unrecognizable did it become to you when it started to morph into a story?
Oh, I don't think it's recognizable. It's these are not, I mean, these have resonances with some kind of cases that people will be familiar with, but they're totally fictional, completely fictional. So I don't think that there's any, I mean, I'm obviously careful of the laws of defamation, but I don't think there's any resemblance to people who are living or dead. There's one story which is based on a story called Ostrich, which is based on the King's Mill atrocity in the north in the 70s, the people who were shot, the linen workers who were shot in the minibus, and that's would be recognisably based on that. But again, it's a fictional character.
Yes, I had wondered specifically about that one because it was so immediately recognisable.
Yes,
a group of workmen coming home, work colleagues coming home in a minibus. They're singled out. The gunman asks, "Which of you is the Catholic?"
Exactly.
And
yeah.
Tells the Catholic to run off, and then proceeds to
gun down the rest.
Gun down everybody else. When you were taking something as sensitive as that King's Mill story and fictionalising it, what kind of considerations did you have to have?
Well, I was conscious that obviously the families of the people were still alive, so you have to be respectful of it. But at the same time, while I wanted to get the factual texture, the background texture correct, I didn't feel that I couldn't make up a story about it, provided it was respectful. And the character in it is fictional, but he clearly is somebody who could have been in that minibus at that time.
Was there something specific about that event in Northern Ireland? There were so many horrific events, not dissimilar to King's Mill, with, you know, you can switch from Protestant to Catholic to tell whatever story it is you want to tell. But the outcome was often the same. A young man or a young person, often innocent victim, lying dead on the side of the road. Was there something about the King's Mill story that particularly caught your attention?
I think the awfulness, the drama of the men being lined up outside the minibus and being asked which one is the Catholic, and I think Seamus Heaney remembers this in his Nobel Prize speech, that when the Catholic goes to answer, his friend says don't say anything and hold his arm. And I think that that transformation, that it turns out that it's not the Catholic they're going to shoot, but it's the others. I think that's an awful moment, and I was very struck by the horror of that.
I'm not surprised that you say there is no resemblance to anybody living or dead in many of the stories, particularly a story called Partners, which of course describes the legal profession. Maybe you'd give us a sense of the lead character here, or your protagonist, Roland. Are all lawyers like this?
Well, he's a solicitor. He's not a barrister.
Solicitor. I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon.
But now, it's funny you say, because somebody told me that story at a party. You'll see that he...
Stop. Somebody told me that story at a party.
But it's a story about a somewhat bumptious lawyer who doesn't realise what his wife is getting up to until his feet start to hurt, and then the explanation is you find out at the end what happens. But that's based on a story that was told to be at a party, but whether it's true or not, who knows?
Yeah, well, what I'm more interested in, yes, there's a touch of what's the difference between a size 9 shoe and a size 9.5 shoe. That's vital to this story, of course, and if you're wearing the one that's too small, you'll know immediately what the difference between the two is. But what we really get at here is the inner machinations of a law firm. Again, I'm sure no resemblance to any law firm.
Absolutely not, Sean. I can't imagine solicitors scheming to become partners or looking to oust people who might be a threat to their on the ladder to success. How could that possibly happen?
Yeah, I'm Sweeney Fletcher Anderson and Co. I don't recognise that name from any golden pages.
Yes, I think they're named in the... They're referred to as Sweet F.A. in the course of the story, yeah.
Yeah, you enjoyed that, but I think you possibly enjoyed even more. Roland's wife, Nikki, is an actor and things have been drying up for her in recent times. But she's about to be involved in a new play called Eurobola. Now, maybe you explain what that play is about. And when did you come up with that title? Surely not in recent times.
No, that story was written, I'd say, 6 or 7 years ago. It was published in The Gloss. Eurobola is a play that her kind of trendy, slightly hopeless appearing boyfriend has written, which is about a virus that is passed by handling money.
And again, like so many people I have spoken to in recent times, it is extraordinary how something written whatever amount of time ago suddenly has a relevance today that you certainly didn't expect.
You were talking to Scott Turow yesterday about testing for vaccines and so on. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it comes up night after night. How different is the experience, John, of writing a poem from writing a short story? I can't imagine that we're into marathon land here, but are we talking kind of about the difference between a sprint and maybe a middle distance run?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you could take a long time to write a short poem, but it takes me much, much longer to write a short story. And they come from a different place. Maybe I'm slightly weird about this, but I use a different pen, I use different pad, notepad. They feel like they come from a different place. And I kind of know if it's going to be a story or if it's going to be a poem. I know pretty much straight away.
Mm. You're not going to tell me you're ambidextrous as well?
No, I'm not. I have enough trouble trying to write with one hand. but it does feel like it comes from a different location, yeah.
There is one story in the book that there's a touch of Tales of the Unexpected about some of the stories, but there was one story in the book that certainly, and I want to be careful about not giving too much away, it's the second story in the book, in fact, a story called Shelley. And if I say that it we realise as it goes on that we're dealing with a sexual assault here, two very young people involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure legally, even if sexual assault is the right word to be used for what you describe in the story.
Well, it is, but a colleague told me about this. Told me that a young boy had been charged with assaulting a young girl, like a very young girl, and I couldn't believe it, and I was wondering how it would happen, and then started to imagine how it would happen, and then how would the court system cope with it? As you know, a number of young or relatively young boys, teens, have been charged with various horrific offences in the last couple of years, but this again was based on a story that somebody had told me, and I was trying to work out how people would the legal system would cope with it, how the social system would cope with it, and so on.
You don't speak in poetry, I'm sure, when you're in court, But there must be an element of prose writing that is something similar to the way you might, you know, take a brief and work it into a kind of dramatic monologue, which is partly what you're doing when you're in court, I guess.
I suppose there are three ways in which the kind of the legal kind of life intersects. I mean, the first, I suppose, is that you're always looking for the exactly correct word. I'm not saying you always find it, but that's you're looking for the word, the nuanced word and the exact correct word. That's the first way. The second thing, though, is that as an advocate, as somebody presenting a case in court, you're telling your client's story and you've got to make it as attractive as you can to the judge or to the jury, whoever's listening. So you've got to engage them and to make it interesting and make it real for them. And that's, I suppose, part of the training that you gain over the years. And that's, I suppose, one of the things that I'm doing as a writer is trying to engage people to listen, to hopefully get them to listen. But then the third thing, the third way in which the kind of lives intersect is, of course, that the material that you learn, the information that you learn engaging with clients and with people down in the courts is amazing. I mean, if you think of what Stephen King said that the only requirement of a writer is the ability to remember the story of every scar. Well, I mean, you think of the number of people who have physical, psychic scars, corporate scars, and you learn so much about so many people. That's, I suppose, a very rich primary source of what people will do to each other.
That suggests to me that the 15 stories that we get in this debut short story collection, Almost the Same Blue, from you, John O'Donnell, there may be other stories sitting in a briefcase somewhere or other.
You may very well think that.
Don't give me the barrister's answer.
Obviously, I can't. It's not ethical to write a story based closely on the facts of a case in which I was involved. That wouldn't be permissible. But there are clearly stories that, you know, I've come across situations or incidents where you could they have been reflected in the stories I've written.
For an awful moment there, I thought you were going to tell me it wouldn't be ethical to tell me what your next book was going to be.
No.
Well, listen, congratulations on the stories. And stories or poems next? What will it be, or do you know yet, John?
I don't know. I'm ploughing through a collection of each. So I don't know which one makes it to the finish line.
Whichever makes it to the surface first. That's John O'Donnell speaking to us about his debut collection of short stories, Almost the Same Blue, which is published by Dura Press. News emerged yesterday that Jimmy Cobb, the last player on the classic Miles Davis album Kind of Blue, had died at the age of 91. Drummer Jimmy Cobb joined the Miles Davis band in 1958 and was part of the 1959 recording sessions that brought Kind of Blue to life. As I said, last of that classic lineup that included Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane on saxophones, Bill Evans and Wynton Kelly on piano, and bassist Paul Chambers. And of course, the great Miles Davis on trumpet. Just let us wallow for a while in those 1959 sessions featuring Jimmy Cobb on drums. This is the opening track to side two of the album, All Blues. Blues from Kind of Blue, and that to remember drummer Jimmy Cobb, who has died at the age of 91. In lieu of the proposed 2020 festival itself, the International Literature Festival Dublin has produced a series of podcast interviews. One of the writers who was due to take part in the festival but subsequently became part of the IFL Dublin podcast is Esther Saffron Foer, whose memoir, I Want You to Know We're Still Here, has just been published. The story of Esther's family history through the Holocaust was partially told in fictionalised form by her son Jonathan Saffron Foer in his 2002 novel Everything is Illuminated. But now Esther has picked up the pen herself to write a fascinating and moving memoir, and she joins me now on the line. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Esther. Your book opens with an earth-shattering revelation your mother made to you when you were in your 40s, which I find it extraordinary that she held it for that long. Tell us what she told you.
Well, you know, just in the course of a routine conversation, she mentioned that I asked her a question about my father during the war, and she said, well, he was on a work detail while his wife and daughter were killed in the ghetto. And this just blew me away because I didn't know that my father had another family that he had a wife and that there was a child before me, that I was not his first daughter. And it was something that sat with me, that, and she didn't have any names to give me. I had a half sibling who had no name, and I had no information.
It, even as you tell it again, it's just extraordinary to think that she had, had held on to that information for so long. But there was, obviously, your family came from Europe over to America during the war, or just after the wartime period. How much of the history was discussed in general in the family? How much of that story was told at, around family dinner tables, at family events, at birthdays, et cetera, et cetera? How much of it was just kept buried?
Most of it was kept buried. I was born to two parents who were Holocaust survivors, who had lost everyone in their respective families. And these were people, like so many of the refugees that survived the war, who wanted to build new lives, who wanted to start again and try to forget what happened. And forgetting meant that they weren't talking about it amongst themselves, they weren't talking about it to their children, that it was this painful period that they were trying to move on from. So there was very little conversation. And so I grew up in a world of lots of silences, and tried to maneuver around the questions I wanted to get answered.
So your mother drops this, as I say, this absolute bombshell to you in your 40s.
How
long does it take you then to say, I want to investigate this. I want to find out more about this.
So, you know, I think I had been investigating it. Well, I had been investigating my family history, those untold secrets, most of my life. I had to kind of keep the information to myself, but I would pick tidbits up from conversations and kind of stash them away in the back of my head. And then I had this newbie, you know, so I was living with all these ghosts, but here I had a ghost who was my half-sibling. And that was really hard to just push to the back of my brain. And as you said in the introduction, I wasn't sure how to pursue this. I pursued it on databases online. But this is kind of the remarkable story. You had an author on earlier. Mm. This is the story of where fiction actually drove the real story. Usually people are making up fiction after they have information. But in 1999, my son Jonathan went to Ukraine as part of his senior project at the university, trying to find the family that had hidden his grandfather. Of course, at that time, he had very little information, found very little as a result of that, and created this work of fiction that suddenly became an international bestseller and then became a movie. I know, it's so ironic. And then people started to call me and say, you know, none of that is true. Well, of course it wasn't true. It was a novel.
Yeah.
But, because of that, they started to tell me, but I know the real story. And I started to put pieces of that real story together so that I could follow his fiction with my own trip to Ukraine to find out the truth.
Well, let us explore just how, I think the exact phrase you used was that your son Jonathan went to Ukraine. How much nudging, how much help in choosing the title for his senior thesis or whatever specific university project he was, how much help did he get in the choice of that from his mother, who was perhaps, who wanted to find out, but perhaps didn't want to delve too deeply? It's the old hornet's nest story, isn't it? If I dig too deeply, what am I going to find out? Can I face what I'm going to find out?
Exactly. You've just nailed the whole thing. I actually got my oldest son, who wrote his high school thesis on his by interviewing his grandmother, likes to tell me now that I was using child labor, that I was using my sons to do what I didn't have the courage to do myself. In the case of my oldest son interviewing his grandmother, I knew that she would tell him things that she wouldn't tell me. Stories between this mother and child were painful. But when you look at your grandchildren, you're looking at immortality. And so she would selectively tell him stories, and he then wrote the outline of the story. But I didn't quite have enough. And then when Jonathan wanted to spend the summer in Prague and needed a senior thesis topic, you're right, I nudged him along and suggested this. And it worked. It worked on two levels. He went, and then he wrote this amazing book, which ultimately led to my search for the truth.
Yeah, and led to you writing your book. And there's a lovely symmetry in this in some ways. You talk about your own son talking to your own mother. That's a, you know, grandmother to grandson communication.
Yes.
In fact, it was your own granddaughter then in turn who was another side to why you wanted to explore your own history.
Exactly. My oldest granddaughter, who has now become the self-proclaimed family historian of her generation, sat with me in my home office, piled high with pictures and boxes, and she looked at me and she said, "Grandma, how am I going to know who these people are?" And I thought, wow, she's really right. And that kind of propelled the project. If this story was going to, if I was going to be able to pass this story on, I had to write it. I had to put the facts down for her to learn and for her to pass on to her grandchildren. So this is very much a multi-generational effort.
You went to Ukraine yourself then to conduct research and to see what you could find of your half-sister. What was that journey like? How difficult a journey was it?
Well, it was a complicated journey. The most difficult thing, I think, was making the decision to go, because I'd obviously put this off while I encouraged my sons to do this work for me. And finally, the time had come. There were a group of people who came from the village that my father's family came from who were going to that village. And it just seemed like a good time to tack my trip on to their trip. But the hardest part wasn't so much making the decision to go, but was telling my mother that I was going. And here you've again got the multi-generational story. I booked my tickets. I booked a hotel. I did it all. My oldest son agreed to go with me. And then I had to call her. And I had to tell her I was doing this. And she blurted out over the phone, "How can you do this to me?" Because she had left this awful place, and she actually never said goodbye to her mother. And here I was saying goodbye to her and going back to this place. Ultimately, she came around, and she called me just before I left, and she said, "Stay in your room, take a good book, buy some granola bars and take them with you, and don't do anything stupid."
Probably something close to what you said to both of your sons when they went.
Very good. Exactly. Exactly.
Who were you addressing, Esther? Or who are you addressing? And I love this part of the story. There, but yeah, I find the idea of your own mother having to leave her mother without saying goodbye, it's absolutely heartbreaking.
Yes.
But the lovely title of this book has such a warmth and such a positive aspect to it. If you know, it's easy to look at it now and say it's warm and positive. It was quite frightening at the time, obviously.
Right. Well, thank you for thinking that, because it was very hard to come up with the title. But ultimately, it was clearly that was it. When I went back to Ukraine, and I was visiting the mass graves of all of my closest relatives except my parents, the mass graves of my grandmothers, of my grandfathers, of my great-grandparents, of my aunts, of my cousins, all the people I grew up without. And I thought, I want to leave something behind. And I chose a picture of our family, which, you know, today has 14, just my branch of our family has 14 members. And I decided I wanted to leave that behind. for what? I don't know. For myself, I guess. And with borrowed forks from the hotel at every mass grave, where I also took a little bit of dirt back with me as something that I was bringing back, I buried this picture. And to me, in my mind, I was saying to my ancestors, we're still here.
Yeah.
They probably all went to their graves thinking no one survived, but we're still here. And well, hence, that was the title of the book.
And an and absolutely beautiful reason and way to commemorate them. Thank you so much for speaking to us this evening. It's an absolute privilege and delight to speak with you and to hear your story.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here with you. And I just want to say one thing. I was born on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes, you were. The 17th of March. So
yes.
Celebrate as you will when the 17th of March. Oh, we were far a bit away from it. When it comes around next year, celebrate
yes,
as you will. Hope
I
you
will.
Had a good time this 17th. That's
it. Well, thank yeah. you so much.
Okay, that's Esther Saffron Foer there speaking to us. And the ILF Dublin podcast series Portals, including Caelan Hogan's interview with Esther and several others, is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. But you can also find it on ilfdublin.com. There are two more in the series. And if Esther is anything to go by, it's well worth logging on to find out more about that. And the book that Esther was speaking to us about, I Want You to Know We Are Still Here, My Family, the Holocaust and My Search for Truth by Esther Saffron Foer, is out now. He's an acclaimed guitarist, songwriter, singer, producer and a former member of the Waterboys. The last time he was in with us on Arena was as a member of the equally acclaimed Dublin band A Lazarus Soul, following the release of their album, The D They Put Between the R and the L. Joe Chester is back with us tonight with his latest solo project, an album entitled Jupiter's Wife. We'll speak with Joe in a few moments' time after we hear this track from the album, a track called The Heart of St. Lawrence O'Toole.
Feasted in the starved in Glendalough.
That's a section there from The Heart of St. Lawrence O'Toole from Joe Chester's recently released solo album Jupiter's Wife. And Joe joins me now. Something about St. Lawrence O'Toole, was that a story that was flying around in the head? Is it something that's been part of your life for a long time? Why did you want to write a song with him in the title, Joe?
Hi, Sean. Actually, that specific story is something that it's quite a recent story about how the heart of St. Lawrence O'Toole actually is a relic that's kept in St. Patrick's Cathedral. He obviously is the patron saint of Dublin. And I came across this story while I was writing the songs for this album. And it was like I was reading this folk ballad that had never been written. You know, it was this incredible story about how it was stolen. This relic was stolen by somebody who snuck into the cathedral and hid there until it closed down. And then left all the valuables, but just stole this relic that was in, you know, a very sort of humble wooden box, you know, and made off with it. And there were no leads at all. Nobody. It was considered a cold case for a few years. And then basically there was an anonymous tip off to the Gardaí where they got this tip off that the heart had been buried in the Phoenix Park. And basically the story goes is that after it had been stolen, the family of this guy started to experience all these terrible, this bad luck, you know. And so they became convinced that they were subject to a curse, you know, because of this thing. So they had to get rid of it and try and get rid of it in such a way that they wouldn't get caught, you know. So so I was reading this article and I was like, oh my God, this is like a Bob Dylan ballad from, you know, the 19th century or something, you know. It was just like, you know, I have to write this song, you know. But, you know, in a way as well, it's just it was a good device as well to enable me to talk about Dublin in a more general way as well, you know.
Yeah, because I wondered if there was a little bit of... how long are you living in the south of France at this stage, Joe?
5 years, Sean.
Yeah, I wondered, was there a little bit of nostalgia for the old sod going on, given that the album is called Jupiter's Wife, yeah. being Juno, if I have my mythology correct.
Yeah, you're right.
I think if anybody hears Juno in Ireland, they're going to think of Juno and the Paycock very quickly, and they're going to think of O'Casey. Was Dublin kind of scratching at you, looking for you to come back in some way?
Possibly. I mean, there's that old Joyce thing where he says, you know, the fastest way to Holly, or the fastest way to Tara is via Holyhead, you know. But I don't actually think so. You know, I think that the songs on this album, I've just put all of myself into them, and in a way, they're songs that took me 40 years to write, you know, and obviously for most of that time I was obviously living and growing up in Ireland, you know. And yeah, no, I just think that's it really. It's not, I'm not a nostalgic person. I think that, you know, nostalgia seems to be all around at the moment, and I think it's a kind of a sickness, you know. That's kind of infecting everything, you know. Like, I mean, every time I go onto social media, I see all this kind of nostalgia, and it's a bit of a turn off for me, you know.
Where do you think all that nostalgia is coming from? What's causing it?
I don't know, Sean. I honestly don't know. I think there is this sort of wave of people thinking that everything was better before, you know, and especially in music, I think, you know, people tend to, I mean, they might be right, you know, but I don't think that's a particularly productive attitude to have, you know. If you're trying to create new music, you know, I think you have to be moving forward all the time, you know. And certainly in my career, I've never tried to repeat myself, you know.
Now, well, Jupiter's Wife, Juno, yes, I made the Juno and the Paycock reference there for my own needs, but in fact, she is the Roman goddess of marriage. You were married, it was just 2 years ago at this point. Do you think that fed into the titling of the album?
You know, there are a lot of marriage songs on it, yeah. So there's some Dublin songs and marriage songs and maybe Dublin marriage songs. I mean, I kind of, for whatever reason, Sean, I don't know why, I find that the Ireland I was born into and I grew up in has been a real rich source of inspiration for me over the last few years. And I kind of, you know, that's definitely kind of informed a lot of the songs on this album, you know, like Staying Together for the Children and stuff like that, you know, that kind of, you know, I mean, I remember when I was a kid in Dublin, it seemed like every couple on the street was in some kind of disarray, you know, or for the families breaking up, you know. And yes, because, you know, it's pre-divorce, sort of stuck together as well, you know. So you kind of have this amazing kind of the kind of hypocrisy of the whole situation and these kind of secrets and almost double lives and everything. And I love all that, you know. So it's like that's great for a songwriter. You can imagine how that would be inspiring, you know. So a lot of the songs are kind of like about that stuff. Yeah.
And Staying Together for the Children is certainly one that treats exactly that.
Now we're staying together.
Staying Together for the Children, one of the songs on Joe Chester's new album, Jupiter's Wife. And I'm glad now that you say that this is a reference back to Ireland pre-divorce, so that neither any of your family or your friends or indeed your wife start worrying about songs like that on an album a couple of years after getting married. Because there's another one there as well, Joe, Nothing at the End, where love forgives everything at the beginning, love forgives nothing at the end. Fairly bleak. You wouldn't want to be feeling that after 2 years now.
Well, no, we were married 5 years. But,
I got that wrong. Beg your pardon.
Yeah, no, you're right. But, you know, it's just funny, Sean, you know, because I've actually read some really over-the-top stuff in the press as well, you know, about this album, you know. Obviously going through a really hard time, you know, or that my marriage is crumbling and everything, you know. But it's so funny because I think it might be because music is such a direct sort of connection with people, you know. People don't feel that about novelists or playwrights, you know, but for some reason, they always think that a songwriter is singing about themselves, you know. And it's because, of course, you write the lyrics and then you sing them. Because, you know, with a novel, you know, somebody, you know, you write the words and then somebody else is reading it. So there is that extra sort of dimension of remove or something, you know. But no, these are stories. These are characters. They're everything's fine.
Well, don't feel too hard done by, because don't worry, I get my wrist slapped by novelists and poets and artists on a regular basis. Oh yeah, when I ask them, is that you? Is that your own story? Is that autobiographical? It's the most annoying. I think it's the most annoying question.
I remember Lou Reed in an interview saying, you know, I wonder did they ask Shakespeare, was Hamlet about him, you know? And it's like typical humility from Lou Reed, you know.
But now, I had an author on a couple of weeks back who would tell you that Hamlet was about Maggie O'Farrell's book, but might tell you that Hamlet was about his son, Shakespeare's son. However, that's another day's work. Now, I also I mentioned the my version of the O'Casey reference in Jupiter's Wife being Juno. There's a song, an instrumental on this called Sing's Chair, but there's also a reference to another dramatic pair in Dublin, Hilton and Michael. And this links in fact, with your last album. Wasn't there a song on your last album, Easter Vigil, a song called Julia in the Rain, which links in with Hilton Edwards and Micheál MacLaymore? And was that part of what set you off to write this song here as well?
Julia Walking in the Rain, yeah. That was, I started writing Hilton and Michael about around the same time, actually. And but it was just one of those songs where I realised that I was going to have to be a bit patient with it. So I just put it away for a while, and actually didn't take it out again until I was working on the songs for this album. And the thing that actually prompted me to take it out again was I was sort of, you know, researching about these two amazing characters, you know, doing a lot of research online, and I found this kind of archive of Micheál MacLaymore's papers, you know, that it's kind of in an internet archive, you know. And in it, I found, you know, there's the text of his play Dermot Agus Coráinne and all the stuff from the Tyark Theatre and everything. But also there was a reference to a play that that had never been performed, and I would never ever have heard of it unless I'd found this archive online. And it just absolutely knocked me down, because when I read the name of it, obviously I had just released a song called Juliet Walking in the Rain, and he had a play, his first play in fact was called Juliet in the Rain. Wow. And I was just like, this is incredible. So I just have to get this song out and finish it. It was like a sign, you know.
All right. Well, let's finish up by listening to Hilton and Michael, or Hilton and Micheál, from Joe Chester's new album, Jupiter's Wife.
While the band plays a soldier's song.
And that's Hilton and Michael from Joe Chester's current album, Jupiter's Wife, released through Bohemia Records, available on Spotify and other platforms. Endless is a new film piece from Derry artist Willie Doherty. Many of Doherty's most iconic works deal with the aftermath of the Troubles. In the past, he's often used news footage or photojournalism and repurposed it to pose questions about what is not told and what is hidden, literally hidden. Endless explores similar territory, but it goes deeper in that a central character is both a victim and a perpetrator of violence, a liar and a creator of truths. He's played by the actor Christopher Eccleston. And in this extract from Endless, he looks back on his past.
I used to worry that my guilt was visible to the whole world. Gradually, I learned to live in this labyrinth of lies and discovered that there were many willing to collude with me. My skills in deception and collusion were widely shared. I was silently initiated in the use of an unspoken code, the mutual recognition of furtive gestures, evasive body language, the choreography of deception. Ultimately, I was alone. Membership of this group could never be acknowledged. each member consigned to bear the burden of sin and deception alone.
The voice there of Christopher Eccleston from a new video work from Willie Doherty, that new work called Endless. Willie joins me now from Donegal. In fact, the central figure here, Christopher Eccleston voicing it and playing it on screen for his haunting performance, and a very haunted man moving around in this restricted space. To what extent are you looking at the specifics of the Northern Irish Troubles, or are you looking for something more universal than that?
Hi, Sean. How are you doing? Nice to be on the show. Well, it's a bit of both, really. I mean, as you just said in your introduction, a lot of my work actually does stem from the experience of the North, and particularly in looking back over the events like post-ceasefire and how we've dealt with that or not dealt with it. And at the same time, I mean, in the autumn of last year, I actually spent a fair bit of time following the impeachment of Trump, and I became caught up in, I suppose as everyone has, in the way in which the ability to lie has become so much part of the political context now that it has in some ways completely distorted our understanding of the norms of political life and the norms of democracy. So in some ways, these things came together, and in also considering that, I was at the same time, I came across the now kind of famous quote from Boris Johnson when he was asked in September in reply to a question if he would promised that he would not go back to Brussels and ask for another delay to Brexit. He said that he would rather be dead in a ditch. And of course, that reminded me of the situation in the North, where many people unfortunately did find themselves dead in a ditch in the context of lying or betrayal. So in a way, a lot of these strands came together, and somehow this work took shape, you know.
Let's listen to a second clip, actually, that gives us a real sense of how what you're talking about there, the unfortunate end that many people came to in Northern Ireland. And this is a dramatic passage where the narrator basically tells us how he met his end.
I was taken out in the end. Brutally, ruthlessly, and without mercy. Back of a car. A country road, beaten to within an inch of my life. I screamed, I prayed, then eliminated, neutralized. I couldn't expect anything else. I knew the rules. My luck ran out. Careless talk, whispers. Up until that point, I had been good at getting myself out of scrapes. I was extremely loyal and efficient, well connected, indispensable. I was in control. No one suspected me. I thought I was above the law. I thought I was invincible.
Christopher Eccleston there in another extract from Willie Doherty's film, video work, Endless. It's chilling when you hear it described in that fashion. I found myself, and I don't know if this is your intention or not, Willie, I found myself feeling sorry for this guy who clearly, as he tells us, had you know, been involved in terrible acts of violence and then died. You know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. What was your intention in telling his story?
Well, I think it's a really powerful performance from Christopher, you know. And I think he, when I showed him the script and he agreed immediately to play the part, I think he understood the complexity of this kind of situation, and by that I mean in somewhere like the North, where in some ways, you know, we're all in some ways implicated by our tacit agreement in some ways to an understanding at least of how the system works, you know, how things work in our kind of language and in the way in which things were allowed to happen in the way that they did. So in some ways the context of deception and lying and the shame associated with that permeates many facets of life. So in some ways the work is a piece about that broader understanding of how lives are lived and the compromises that people make and the mistakes that people make. So this is a man who has made mistakes. He's made decisions that he cannot reverse. And I was interested in the possibility of the figure being a kind of a ghost, a specter, and speaking in some ways from beyond the grave. And it's something that I've used in the work in the past. I made a work a number of years ago called Ghost Story, which had a similar kind of quality, if you want. So it's a work of fiction as well. To have the character be both physically lair in the space, you know, as he talks, you can see his breath. But at the same time, he's an absence. He's a character who defies logic in a way.
And I don't want to spoil it, and anybody who goes to watch it online, but just the closing sections then will explain the title of the piece and give us the frightening prospect that this is cyclical and that there is no end.
That makes it all sound rather depressing, but in some ways that's a kind of structural thing within the work that it should start again. But at the same time, there is something about kind of unfinished business as well. That at times makes the suffering of people who are still searching for questions and answers to some of the events of the past seem like an endless pursuit. So I hope that the work is touches upon those different layers of possibility and context that I hope it delves into.
Right, Willie. Well, listen, thanks for speaking to us about it this evening. That's Willie Doherty there speaking to us about Endless. And you can access that video work, by the way, with Christopher Eccleston through the Carlin Gallery website. There was an intention to show it as in the gallery, but obviously that can't happen at the moment. The website the gallery is carlingallery.com. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Tonight's programme produced by Olam Gunn.